This is Family Policy Matters. This program is produced by the North Carolina Family Policy Council, a pro-family research and education organization dedicated to strengthening and preserving the family. And now from the studio, here's John Rustin, president of the North Carolina Family Policy Council.
Thank you for joining us this week for Family Policy Matters. It is our pleasure to have Ryan Anderson with us on the program. Ryan is the William E. Simon Fellow at the Heritage Foundation and the editor of Public Discourse, the online journal of the Witherspoon Institute. Ryan previously served as assistant editor of First Things, and his writings have appeared in the Harvard Journal of Law and Public Policy, the Weekly Standard, National Review, and the New Atlantic. Ryan is also the keynote speaker at the North Carolina Family Policy Council's upcoming Major Speakers Series Dinner in Greenville, North Carolina on March 24th. We're very excited about this event and invite you to contact the North Carolina Family Policy Council for more information if you are interested in attending. Our number is 919-807-0800. Ryan is with us today to talk about the escalating threat to religious liberty posed by efforts to redefine marriage throughout our nation. There have been a number of cases across the country involving Christian business owners who have been penalized or even forced to close because they have operated their businesses according to their deeply held religious beliefs, particularly regarding their beliefs about traditional marriage. The issue came to a head recently when Arizona's governor, under pressure from homosexual activist groups, vetoed religious liberty legislation in that state that would have strengthened protections for people of faith. We will be talking with Ryan about the Arizona legislation as well as the broader implication of efforts to redefine marriage in our culture. Ryan, thanks so much for being back with us on Family Policy Matters.
Happy to be with you. Thanks for having me.
Well, our pleasure. Ryan, I'd like to start with the Arizona Religious Freedom Bill, which was Senate Bill 1062. As I mentioned, this bill was vetoed on February 26 by Arizona Governor Jan Brewer. There has been a great deal of misinformation in the media about the bill, namely that it was, quote, anti-gay and would have allowed businesses to blatantly discriminate against homosexuals. Tell us about the Arizona bill, Senate Bill 1062, and what it really did and why pro-family groups considered it to be a model piece of religious freedom legislation, not only for Arizona, but potentially for other states as well.
You know, SB 1062 was simply a minor amendment to clarify religious liberty protections that are already on the books in the state of Arizona. These religious liberty state measures are modeled off of the federal Religious Freedom Restoration Act. So these are mini RFRAs, as they're called. The federal Religious Freedom Restoration Act was a bill that passed the House by unanimous vote, and then passed the Senate by a vote of 97-3, and then it was signed into law in 1993 by President Bill Clinton. So we've been living under this law for 20 years now, and it had broad bipartisan support. And what it said is that the federal government cannot substantially burden the free exercise of religion unless there's a compelling state interest that the government's pursuing in the least restrictive means possible. So it sets a pretty high standard of review, a high bar to clear before the government can coerce someone and violate religious liberty. In 1999, Arizona passed a state version of this bill, saying that the state government can't substantially burden religion unless, again, it's a compelling state interest pursued in the least restrictive means possible. All they were doing last week with a proposed piece of legislation was trying to clarify and to specify what had been implicit throughout the past 20 years, was that the word person, when it says Congress can burden a person's exercise of religious freedom, included corporate persons, that it included organizations and associations and business communities. The idea being that Americans enjoy religious liberty protections not just if they're clergy, not just if they're inside of a chapel, but also if they're private citizens engaged in the marketplace, running their family businesses, running their corporations. And that this was trying to say that all members of Arizona deserve religious liberty protections. It wouldn't have changed anything about the standard of review, again, substantial burden, least restrictive means, compelling state interest, those sorts of things. It didn't mention gays or lesbians or marriage or same-sex anything. And yet we got several weeks of nonstop media lies and misrepresentations and just demagoguery, and that forced the hand of the governor to veto but otherwise was a perfectly good piece of legislation.
Now, if you saw news reports in the days leading up to the veto in Arizona, it was just amazing the activity that homosexual activist groups and other groups and even a number of Fortune 500 businesses were undertaking. And really, there was a major distortion campaign launched by homosexual activists and others. Why, in your opinion, Ryan, did we see such a heavy attack on this particular bill in Arizona?
Sure. You know, I think part of this is that there's a certain push among those on the left, those in favor of redefining marriage, not just to redefine marriage in the law, but to force every citizen and every institution of civil society and every business into treating a same-sex relationship as a marriage. So all of a sudden, religious liberty becomes threatening to them because that would protect those individuals who believe what the U.S. government up until last year officially believed about marriage and what the state of Arizona currently believes about marriage. To a certain extent, they can see that the Supreme Court may strike down state marriage amendments in the near future. And then if that does happen, they don't want individuals, their communities, and their business associations to be free to continue to believe and to act on the belief that marriage is the union of a man and a woman.
So individuals that have, for the past several years, promoted the notion of tolerance and equality are acting absolutely contrary to that notion. Would that be your assessment of this?
You know, the basic argument that we've heard for decades now is that those in same-sex relationships wanted the freedom to live and to love how they wanted to. Well, the freedom to live and to love how you want to doesn't include the right to then coerce other people into celebrating your romantic relationship as a marriage. So the freedom to live and to love how you want to has a corollary freedom of the freedom to live and to work and to run a family business in accord with one's own values, not government-coerced values.
Well, Ryan, traditional marriage supporters have been warning about these religious liberty implications of the legalization and recognition of same-sex marriage for years. Why does same-sex marriage pose such a significant threat to religious liberty? And what kind of cases, especially related to businesses, have we seen across the country that have brought this issue to the forefront?
Sure. You know, in New Mexico, a photographer declined to use her artistic talents to promote a same-sex ceremony because of her religious beliefs about marriage. And then the New Mexico Human Rights Commission ordered her to pay a fine of nearly $7,000. Christian adoption and foster care agencies in Massachusetts, Illinois, and Washington, D.C. have been forced to stop providing those services because they believe the best place for kids is with a married mom and dad. And then other examples include a baker, a florist, a bed and breakfast, a student counselor, the Salvation Army, and more. More or less, every industry that runs up against marriage, whether it's a photographer or a florist, an innkeeper or a baker, whether it's adoption and foster care providers, all these institutions that intersect with the marriage business, the wedding industry, the marriage relationship, all of them could be potentially at risk. And we've seen arguments from those in the Obama administration that say religious freedom is just the freedom to worship. It's something that priests and pastors enjoy on Sunday mornings inside the four walls of their church, and it's something that worshipers enjoy on Sunday mornings. But they're cabining it in. That's not what the free exercise of religion, which is what our Constitution protects, is discussing. It's not just the freedom to worship, it's the freedom to enter into public life and to lead your life in accordance with your religious beliefs, to bring those values into the civil society, into the marketplace, onto Main Street, and onto Wall Street. And that's what we need to be protecting with religious liberty protections.
Well, Ryan, advocates for marriage redefinition, including homosexual activist groups, argue that same-sex marriage does not pose a threat to religious liberty because they say that pastors, priests, and other clergy in America will never be forced to perform same-sex weddings or to preach that same-sex marriage or same-sex relationships are acceptable. First, is this true, and doesn't the issue of religious liberty go further than just what is preached from the pulpit or whether a pastor performs a wedding ceremony?
Yes, of course, religious liberty is for all Americans, not just for the ordained. And so the first point to make here is that it's important that we never coerce what is preached in the pulpit or what is celebrated at the altar. But the second point to make here is that that can't be the only religious liberty that we protect. Religious liberty is for all Americans, every day of the week, not just the ordained on Sunday mornings. That said, it does seem that we have a solid set of Supreme Court precedents and case law that would say that the government cannot coerce the priest, the pastor, or other clergy members into performing a same-sex wedding or into preaching that same-sex marriage is acceptable. At the very least, that religious belief and that free exercise of religion should be protected and will be protected given current Supreme Court jurisprudence. The real question right now is whether or not that will be the only religious liberty that's protected. And I think this is where all Americans need to jealously guard our liberties and demand that the government not coerce our beliefs or our actions with respect to marriage, whether it be in church on Sunday morning or in the workplace Monday through Saturday.
Well, Ryan, an increasing number of states, 17 in fact, plus the District of Columbia, are redefining marriage to include the union of same-sex couples, mostly through court rulings and in a few cases through legislative action. Most of the incidents involving religious businesses or organizations have occurred in states where same-sex marriage has been made legal. How can government and the citizens best protect their rights of religious individuals to operate their businesses and to live their lives according to their deeply held religious beliefs about marriage and family, particularly in states where marriage has been redefined by the legislature or the courts?
All states should have two pieces of general legislation that can protect religious liberty. The first is the state-level RFRA, the State-Level Religious Freedom Restoration Act, which simply says that the government cannot substantially burden a sincere religious belief unless there's a compelling state interest that the government's pursuing in the least restrictive way possible. This would protect all sorts of religious beliefs, and it would have a high burden for the government to meet before it violates religious liberty. In addition to the state-level RFRAs, there are also state-level MARFAs. MARFA stands for the Marriage and Religious Freedom Act. And this would specifically single out the belief that marriage is the union of a man and a woman and say that this is a reasonable belief that government ought not to penalize, ought not to coerce, ought not in any way to take retaliatory action towards those citizens and the communities, the organizations that they form who believe and then act on the belief that marriage is the union of a man and a woman. So that one would specifically single out this understanding of what marriage is and say this was the official legal understanding of marriage for 200 some years in the United States. Those who continue to believe this about marriage should not be coerced or penalized by the government.
Now, a bill related to that has been introduced in the U.S. Congress that would address some of these issues that you were just speaking about. Can you tell us about that piece of legislation and how it might help?
Sure. This is the Marriage and Religious Freedom Act at the federal level, which was introduced in the House by Representative Raul Labrador and has been introduced in the Senate by Senator Mike Lee. And what this more or less says is that the federal government cannot take retaliatory or punitive action against a citizen or against the communities that those citizens form based upon their belief that marriage is the union of a man and a woman, whether it comes to government grants or contracts, accreditation, government loans, government anything in which the government kind of is intersecting with civil society. It can't discriminate against someone because they believe marriage is the union of a man and a woman. It would prevent the government from violating their religious liberty rights.
Well, unfortunately, Ryan, we're nearly out of time for this week. Where can our listeners go to read more about the clash between religious liberty and same-sex marriage, and also to learn more about the Heritage Foundation and your great work there?
Sure. Just go to heritage.org. That's the website for the Heritage Foundation. I've also written a book on this topic titled What is Marriage? Man and Woman, a Defense. There's a website for the book, just whatismarriagebook.com. It just makes a rational argument that marriage is the union of a man and a woman.
Thank you for taking time to talk with us this week. We're really looking forward to having you join us at our Greenville dinner on March 24th. And again, if our listeners are interested in information about that event, contact the North Carolina Family Policy Council at 919-807-0800. Again, 919-807-0800. And please be sure to visit the Heritage Foundation at heritage.org. And again, avail yourselves of the great information that Ryan Anderson is providing about the basis for marriage as the union of one man and one woman. Ryan, thank you again for being with us.
Sure thing. Thanks for having me.
Family. Family Policy Matters is an information and analysis feature of the North Carolina Family Policy Council. Join us weekly for discussion on policy issues affecting the family. If you have questions or comments, please contact us at 919-807-0800 or visit our website at ncfamily.org.